Hello and welcome to episode 10 of A Life in the Landscape, the photography podcast with me, Peter Cox, and my good friend. What's your name again? Roger something?
Yes.
Roger.
Mr. Something to you. Thank you very much.
It's been a while. I've forgotten your name.
I've got my name, forgotten my face.
Yes. Roger overall, of course. Yes.
A face for radio. Very good. Well, gosh, it's been a while, but you've been busy. I mean, you've barely been in the country. You've barely had a foot on land, is kind of the impression I have.
Most of the time, my brain is somewhere else anyway. Whatever, wherever my feet are, my brain's not on land. Yes, it's been, July was the last time we did this. And so that's the height of the summer between us and then. And I suppose I was on a couple of photography workshops. I had two in Ireland, one that I was running for myself and one that I was running for my good friend, John Barkley, who's a wonderful American photographer. And also had a trip in Svalbard, which I've been looking forward to for a couple of years.
So at the Irish summer, and we had a brilliant summer, by the way. It was phenomenal. Was it too hot for you? So you decided, I've had enough. I'm heading to the north. I'm heading to the polar circle is where I'm going. I've had enough of this weather.
Exactly. Yeah, give me 5 degrees and snow. yeah, it was far too hot. I was melting. I needed to. In fact, I probably contributed to global warming by going up there and bringing some of that Irish heat back to the door.
People on the trip saying to you, yeah, you're not used to this cold, are you, Peter? Living in Ireland as you do. Exactly. Which does actually beg the question. Okay, so you were in Svalbard, which is in the polar circle, near the polar circle?
So it's the Arctic Circle is around 66 degrees north, and Svalbard ranges from between 78 to 80 degrees north.
Okay, so it's quite far north.
Yes.
Is it covered in ice at this time of year? Well, when you went in the summer months, is it covered in ice? Is it snowbound? Or does the landscape change at all?
The landscape changes. So during the winter, it's entirely covered in snow. There's sea ice all around. But during the summertime, it's not. There is snow. There are glaciers, which are more and less than they were, depending on where you are. But you will find there's lots of tundra, right? So there's you find basically tundra, which is the Arctic version of Irish bogland. And there's plenty of that. And it can be very, very soft, but it's also very beautiful. And you get these, sort of grasses and mosses. And then you find these little gardens where animals have died, and you'll find little flowers coming up in the area where the animal when the animal dies, you know, scavengers will come and take care of a lot of the corpse, but then a lot of it is left behind, and even the bones lend nutrients to the soil. So you actually get these lovely little areas of wildflowers that pop up to mark the grave of some animal that's died.
So what you're saying is wherever you see flowers, there's some dead stinking animal has been rotting away under the soil.
There you go, exactly.
So were you on land then, as you were going over these tundras and these flowers and these dead animals on your little dead animal safari? Were you traveling by land over?
No, it's all ship-based. So we fly into Longyearbyen, which is the biggest town in Svalbard, which is mostly a wilderness area, but there are a couple of settlements, Longyearbyen being the biggest. And it's a little bit like the Arctic shopping center, really. It's because it sees so much tourism. So it's a town of maybe 2,000 people in the summer. It goes down to maybe, I don't know, 600 or 800 in the winter, or even less perhaps. And there are lots and lots of really high-end outdoor shops, because all of the people that go through there tend to be fairly high-end tourists. And the funny thing is, actually, that I was running this trip with my friend Daniel Bergman, who's a wonderful Icelandic photographer that I've known for many years. And he was actually came there with a shopping list, because Svalbard is a tax-free area. So there's no VAT, there's no income tax. But if you're buying anything there, it's VAT-free. So Longyearbyen is under Norwegian control, as Svalbard is in general. And so you're paying Norwegian prices without the VAT, which is still pretty expensive, but it's actually cheaper than buying the same stuff in Iceland. So he came over with a list of things he needed to buy for his partner and for his daughters.
I can just see this conversation between you and him, and he's going, Peter, look at the price on that. And you're looking at it going, holy crap, that, Yeah, whoa.
Exactly.
Whoa. You're both looking at it from completely different angles.
Same planet, different worlds. Although actually I did, I dropped a few euro there because it's a fantastic place to get at Dorgia. Because even though it is a bit more expensive than here, you can walk into a shop and you can see everything there. So you can know exactly what you're after. So every time I've gone up there, I've always bought some stuff. It suits the Irish summers very well.
So talk a bit about this, if it was boat-based, ship-based, luxury liner. I just imagine you know, QE2 kind of.
So no, we were on a sailing vessel called the Antigua, which is a barkentine, which is a three-masted sailing vessel. And it's obviously got a motor as well, which we spent a lot of time on. But we were able to sail a bit. And it's all traditional sailing, so there's no winches or anything like that. It's all done by main force. So the crew is fairly small. And when the sails are coming up and going down, they encourage and they can manage the sails themselves, but it makes it a lot easier and more enjoyable for everybody, really, if the passengers participate. So that was good fun. But it's a lovely ship. It was actually extended fairly recently, a few years ago, but not all that many years ago. So they basically cut it in half and then slapped a bit in the middle to make it longer and welded it back together, which happens to ships quite a bit. And you'd think you'd be able to see or tell the difference, but you really can't. But it also improved its handling and its sailing, so it's a much more comfortable vessel. But yeah, it's a lovely little ship and a lovely little sort of lounge in the stern area. And any sailing vessel, if you are under sail and if the water is rough, it's much more comfortable to be on a sailing vessel than on a non-sailing vessel, because you end up with the sails stiffen the ship, so you end up with a lot less rolling.
Well, it's lost on me because any kind of swell, like a swell in a cup of tea, will make me seasick. So this is, strikes me as a fairly serene, sedate way of getting around. So you're ship-based, you're going along the coast. How often were you able to go on that?
Every day. So the way that these trips tend to run, because when people go to Svalbard, it's generally wildlife focused. Svalbard is a place that is very, very beautiful in a landscape sense, but it's also full of amazing wildlife, most notably the polar bear. And it's also the closest place, or one of the closest places, where you can get to polar bears on ice, which is, of course, the main thing that people are interested in seeing, because that's a unique habitat where you've got this land mammal that actually lives on the sea ice. In fact, the polar bear is classified as a marine mammal. But it's becoming harder and harder to get bears on ice, both because, although there's no official numbers, it seems to be that the bears are in decline because they've got the dual pressures of climate change and hunting on them, although they're not hunted in the Norwegian Arctic. But they do range into areas where they are hunted. And then you also have the sea ice is basically retreating further and further north every summer. So you have to travel further to get to the sea ice. So you typically will cover large distances on these trips. But what we did with this trip was we advertised it as a landscape trip, which is the first time that Daniel or I had really done serious landscape photography in Svalbard. Because when you're chasing over long distances looking for bears, you don't get to spend time and really explore the landscape. So we were able to do in the past some sort of token tripod-based photography, but it was limited in scope and in quality, really. So this trip, we wanted it to be landscape-focused, so we informed the clients before when they were signing up, and the advertising material was all, we'll see bears, but we're not going to go find bears on ice. We will not be even trying to do that. The wildlife will be sort of incidental to the main focus, which is landscape. So this gave us a really great opportunity when we got on the trip to have a lot of fun and find, you know, either there were some spots that we had been to that we said, geez, if only we could be here in better light or spend some time here and really work the landscape. We were able to visit those. And we were also then able to look at the map and say, okay, well, here are some areas that look really promising. And those caused some interesting things, because we were using this, the Norwegian Polar Institute have a wonderful map that they produce and make available for free. You can buy print copies, but they make it an electronic version available for free. And we were using that and we were browsing over it. And it's a really nice topographical map that shows the glaciers and the mountains really clearly. And so we look at these bays and go, wow, this looks amazing over here. Let's check this out. And so we talk to the captain and we'd figure out, okay, it's going to take us 8 hours of sailing to get from here to there. So we'll be there in the morning and we get there. And generally speaking, they all worked out very well. But the ice was never in the same place because glaciers, of course, move and they advance and they retreat. And the vast majority of the ones that we found were, in fact, in retreat and had retreated significantly from where the map said they were. And even though you knew that was going to happen, you'd still be kind of fooled because the map is so... But there was always, you know, we'd get there and the basic characters that would make the location interesting were still there. And in fact, in some cases, you know, the glaciers will have retreated and will have left behind little rocky islands that would have been covered before that make for fantastic vantage points. And in fact, what we ended up doing a lot was landing on these little skerries, these little rocks with no vegetation of any kind, just bare rock that's just maybe at most 2 or 3 meters above the water and maybe the size of a football field or a lot smaller. And we would set up tripods and use that as a foreground for whatever was behind the glacier front or a cliff. And what we really found that was a little bit unexpected, at least for me, was that many of these skerries were astoundingly rich in the foreground material they could offer. You had these amazing patterns in the rocks. You have colors, lines, textures, little cracks, all these kinds of things that you could find and use as a foreground. And you could spend, I mean, you know, and we had the clients with us, of course, and they're all photographing. And it's because the foregrounds are small and the rock was fairly big, there's plenty of space for everybody to find a place that works for them. And, you know, the clients would have quite happily spent 4 or 5 hours. And in fact, on some of the places we did spend 4 hours on one of the landings, and people didn't want to leave at the end, but we had to go. And again, many of these would be things that people will have passed them by, but whether anybody had ever landed on some of them at all, you know, because unless you're a crazy landscape photographer, there'd be no point.
There'd be no reason to.
No. Exactly. But there was one particular spot. It was right at the end of the trip. And it had been a spot that I'd looked at from the beginning, because it's actually in Isfjorden, which is the fjord that contains Longyearbyen. So we spent our first couple of days in this fjord, which is large and very diverse. And we had looked at this one, but just logistically, it wasn't working out to get there because there were other things we wanted to do that were more important. And on the last day, we looked at it and actually the circumstances aligned such that it made sense to go check it out. And it was this bay that had this glacier in a sort of a C shape, fairly narrow glacier front. And then there was a spine of rock that came down from the north right in front of it. And it just looked like on the map, like it would be this really interesting foreground and plenty of really dynamic opportunities. So we went there and nobody had been there that was on the ship. Like none of the crew had been there. Myself and Daniel hadn't been there. Morten and Nozomi, who were our guides, hadn't been there. And so we figured, let's check it out. So we get up there and we arrive and I go up on deck and I'm looking for this spine of land and I don't see it. And then I look kind of onto the glacier and behind the glacier front and I see this fucking glacier. Of all the glaciers in Svalbard, this one had advanced. It had surged since the map was drawn. So it had completely subsumed this. So by maybe 400 or 500 meters, this spine. So instead of it being a tripod-based landscape stop, it ended up being a really nice zodiac cruise along the glacier front because it was a beautifully calm day and there were fantastic icebergs and we got several carvings that people were able to photograph. So it turned into a very different experience.
You would not have expected that a glacier would advance.
Because I remember looking at the map and thinking, well, that looks really good. And the glacier's changed, but it's gone back.
Yeah.
And yeah, that would still work even though it's gone back and... exact opposite.
So on board this sailing ship, I'm very curious because you're in quite a remote location as well. Wi-Fi deprivation must have been a massive problem. You know, back in the day, 17th century, it was scurvy and that was the real issue. If you're out sailing on these adventures for long, long periods of time, teeth were falling out. But you had to put up with something far worse. No Wi-Fi. How on earth did you prevent mutiny and just basically people killing themselves?
The funny thing about that is the first trip that I made to Svalbard, and indeed both trips prior that I'd made, where it was very much, we're disconnected, we are out of coverage, You know, there's a satellite phone on the ship. You can give that number to your next of kin if they need to contact you, whatever. But only in emergencies. And it was very much unplugged. And this trip was actually it was a 10-day trip. And I'd say we had probably 3 or maybe even 4 days where we were in Isfjorden, which is close to Longyearbyen. And Longyearbyen has actually got very good internet access. and because we were in that area and because of the EU and all the rest of it, and roaming not being a thing anymore, I was able to. I could have been video chatting with you from Longyearbyen. Now
this is insane. Here you are in the Arctic Circle. Wi-Fi not a problem.
Now that being said, as soon as you go around the corner and leave line of sight from Longyearbyen, then there is no coverage. And so for the rest of the trip, yeah, I mean, it is really nice. And it was a little disturbing nearly for me to have that coverage, but it was really nice at the same time being able to video chat with Anne and Liam and sort of show them where I was and, you know, show Liam whatever, like a walrus or something like that, you know, and he'd be able to see that in real time, which was really nice, but it also just felt wrong.
Amundsen is frowning, turning in his grave as you say these words. You know that, don't you?
Absolutely.
Okay, so Svalbard, amazing trip, clearly. Very much enjoyed it. Any plans to go back to that region? Because there'll be people listening to this and they'll be thinking to themselves, sod it, I missed that opportunity. Have these people, is that it now? They'll never have a chance? Or are you
going to... No, I'll definitely be going back. And so I've no immediate plans to go back to Svalbard, although there is a sort of a back burner plan that in a few years we'll go back there. But myself and Daniel are going to be running a trip in Eastern Greenland in 2020. Dates to be confirmed and everything else. We're just at the very initial stages now, but we have decided that we're going to do it. And I'm very excited about that because Eastern Greenland, I've been to before, twice. Scoresby Sund, which is the world's largest fjord system. We're going to be taking a group in. And again, this is a landscape-focused trip. Greenland is not as wildlife-intense as Svalbard is. Like, there are bears there, but you're much less likely to see them. But it is an even more impressive landscape than Svalbard. You know, the mountains are bigger, the glaciers are bigger, the icebergs are Antarctic in proportion. You know, I mean, having been to the Antarctic and seen the icebergs there and seen the ones in Greenland, I'm like, you know, actually, and I might have even said this on this podcast before, if given the opportunity tomorrow between going back to Antarctica or going to Greenland again, I would choose Greenland. Uh-huh. There's just something about it that I enjoyed more. I enjoyed both immensely, but I did enjoy Greenland more. So we're quite excited about that. And it's a place that I was last there in 2015 on a small ship, a very small ship with just 4 clients. And that was one of the, it's probably the trip that I've enjoyed most that I've ever undertaken, both professionally and personally. So I'm very keen to go back. And Daniel is a wonderful guy to run these things with. You know, he's very deadpan sense of humor and we get along very well.
So, listener, if you want in on this, on the ground floor, so to speak, get in touch with Peter now. Reserve your spot, and then he'll tell you the price later on. Once you've fully committed and signed the contracts, then he'll tell you how much it will cost. Okay, so while you've been away gallivanting up in the polar circle, I've been here in Ireland, and I have not been able to escape you. I cannot turn the television on. Or it's like the Peter Cox special is all over, and then multiple episodes. My wife is commenting on it, and I'm sick of it, quite frankly. So there have been programs about Irish lighthouses. There's been a television series on Irish television, and that's been airing over the summer and the last few weeks anyway. And tell us about your connection.
So I've had a long interest in and slightly unhealthy obsession with Irish lighthouses for quite a while. And I had actually been aware that this program was being produced. It's been in production for the last 4 years, but somehow I hadn't quite connected with the producers. And about a few months ago, I was approached by the producer because they needed some footage of a couple of the lighthouses off the West Coast. And so I was asked if I could provide that. As it turned out, I didn't have the footage to hand, so I had stuff, but it wasn't exactly what they were looking for. So I ended up being commissioned by them to go out and do some aerial footage of a few of the lighthouses off the west coast, Inishtiaracht, which is the westernmost Blasket, and also the westernmost point of Ireland, actually, and Skedigmichael, and also the Fastnet Rock. So I've, you know, it's just really interesting to be involved in it. And then having seen the end result, because I'd been talking to them about this, but hadn't seen any footage that they had shot. And over the last 4 weeks, the last episode aired last Sunday, the program has gone on. And it's basically been a general program about the Irish lighthouses. So it's called Great Lighthouses of Ireland, and it aired on RTE. If you're in Ireland, you can get it on the RTE player still. If you're not in Ireland, you might actually still be able to. I'm not sure what the restrictions are. Possibly not, but you just have to come to Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. Come to Ireland, visit the lighthouses. There you are. Was it just lighthouses that you were filming, or did you do any general coastal stuff for them? Because I just seem to watch these programs and just had in my head, oh, Peter must have done that, and he must have done that, and he must have done that. Or was it purely just the lighthouses?
It was the lighthouses, and it's interesting because the producer, who's a very nice man called David Hare, my footage was used in all four episodes, but because I came into it late, the earlier episodes had sort of more or less locked, and they had a couple of things they needed specific imagery of, but otherwise they had everything else already set. So even though, probably let's say in the first episode, I think there was probably 5 seconds of my footage in the hour-long program, mm-hmm. I get equal, pretty much co-aerial credit with the director of photography, the photographer essentially that shot all the rest of the program, who also did a lot of aerial, very fine aerial work, really nice aerial work. It's aerial photography, Billy Keady and Peter Cox. And so anybody looking at it who knows my name, and then they see the stuff, and his stuff, you know, looks very much like mine, the very kind of same style. And they're like, oh, you know, Peter, I just saw that Irish Lighthouses program and such wonderful photography, so nice. And I have to say, yeah, most of that wasn't mine.
Well, you know, look, when people start saying to you, I saw your Irish Lighthouses program, then, oh, yes, it was all me. Written by Peter Cox, directed by Peter Cox.
So very much not. And Billy did a fantastic job with the work that he had. But then the last two episodes had more of my imagery in it. And so any of the stuff that's of the Skellig, any of the stuff that's of Inishtiaracht, and the stuff that shows the Fastnet with the new light on it. So I got to go out onto the Fastnet, which would be the third time that I've overnighted there, which is an amazing privilege. The Fastnet, for those that don't know, is a very isolated rock. It's about 8 kilometers offshore. It's the southernmost part of Ireland, and it's a dramatic lighthouse. There's a big sailing race that goes around it it's not every year, I don't think, it's every few years. But anyway, it's iconic, and it's one that I've been fascinated with for a very long time. And there is change happening with the lighthouses around the coast, which if you watch the program is explained. But essentially, it's migrating from the old incandescent bulbs, which take 1,000 watts typically, and they look like huge domestic light bulbs, into LEDs. And the change has been controversial. I'm not a big fan of many of the lighthouses that have been changed, because they have blinking lights instead of the wonderful sweeping beams that we're used to. And when I heard that they were going to put an LED on the Fastnet and put it on the very peak of the roof, I imagined it was just going to be a blinking light and that would kill the character of the lighthouse. But in fact, to their credit, it is a revolving beam. It's much less powerful than the other one, but it's enough for the navigational purposes. But it does mean when you go onto the rock, you know, having been on it at night many times and looking up from the rock up to the top of the lighthouse, and you can see this beautiful glow coming from the lantern room. And then you can see the spokes of light coming out. Now the lantern room is black. And in fact, if it's not fully dark, you can't actually tell the lighthouse, the light is on, except by looking at the telltale inside.
So, and all that magnificent engineering in the lantern room, what's going to happen to that? I mean, is it going to be maintained so that if they needed to switch it on, they could? Or is this now completely redundant, may even be stripped out, melted down for
whatever? Well, they never remove the lantern itself, because even if they had a valid reason to, there would be, you couldn't, you know, it's just impractical to do it. So you just leave it in place. And what they did was it had a bearing, which was a mercury bearing. So there was basically this little trough of mercury that the lantern sat in. it was so well engineered that when that was in place, and I've done this myself, if the light is stopped, like the lantern never stops rotating, because if it does, then it burns holes and things. It's like a magnifying glass that you're shining the sun through. So they keep it rotating during the day even. But one time I was out there the attendant was telling me, you know, how well engineered it was. And I didn't quite believe him when he said that you could start it going with just your little finger. Just putting your little finger on the rotating part and applying gentle pressure, and it would move. And so he stopped it momentarily during the day while he was maintaining it, and said, hey, see if you can get it going there. And sure enough, all I needed was just the pressure of my little finger on it to get a 10-ton lantern turning.
Power of your own strength.
Pardon me? Yes, exactly.
You are, in fact, a superhero. You've given it away now.
But that is quite remarkable. Mercury is not the best substance to be using with this, because it's a nasty substance and it vaporizes at a low temperature. And if you breathe it in, there's problems. So they have a program of removing mercury from all of the lighthouses around the coast. In fact, when mercury became a controlled substance and you had to report if you had more than a certain amount of it, Irish Lights got in touch with the body that was in charge of that. And we said, yeah, we've got some mercury that we need to report. And they said, okay, how much do you have? And I can't remember the amount that they had, but it was like maybe 100 liters, you know, and the guy's like, no, nobody has that much. You're kidding. You must be wrong. So anyway, they've removed, I think probably a lot or most of the lights around the coast have had it removed. And in the case of the Fastnet, that means now that the lantern no longer rotates because they've drained that. And it's now sitting there. You'd need even with a heavy machine, you wouldn't be able to get it to turn. And they've shrouded the lantern. So from the outside, it still looks the same, but they've got shrouds on the inside.
Yeah.
That stop it from doing any damage.
Yeah.
But presumably in the future sometime, if a mechanical bearing is introduced, if they decide to do that, and I hope that they would, basically turn off this new light that's on top, put an LED in the original lantern and use a mechanical bearing to keep it going. I think that would be very welcomed, because
it's you're getting to the point where the lighthouse was a place for people to live, for people to work, and you, as you say, you had these lantern rooms with these incredible feats of engineering. Really, what you're talking about now is it's just a very long pole with an LED at the top, and that's kind of what it's been reduced to.
Yeah,
which is very sad in a way. It's like it's lost its soul.
It's a difficult thing to do, and I mean, at the very least, the new light, which I was there to film. That was why I was out there this last time, and so they wanted for the video or for the program to be as be able to show what was going on. It had only been on for a couple of weeks at that stage. And in fact, the scaffolding that they had erected around the lantern room in order to build this on top was still there. So, and just even the act of putting that scaffolding up, and we're at that height in those conditions, I mean, these guys have incredible skill at their job. And also, I mean, balls of steel, because to do that in that environment, I don't know. So anyway, it doesn't look out of place. You know, it matches the profile of the lighthouse very well. And it's only at night that you can tell that anything is different. And even then, at least it is still this revolving beam. So it's better than it could have been, but it's not as good as it should have been.
Fair enough. Well, before this becomes the chemistry and physics podcast.
Yes, so we've strayed a bit from the subject. But lighthouses are fun, damn it.
Anyway, moving on. You've had various other trips.
I have, yeah. So there were two Irish trips. And the second one of those, as I said, was with my friend John Barclay. And that was an enjoyable trip. It was, it was all his clients that he brought. So I just basically, did all the organization and then showed up and guided the trip for him. And it's always fun. But, the thing when you run photography workshops by yourself is that it's all fine until something happens that means that you can't run the trip yourself. And so poor John. So John's wife, who's a lovely woman who I'd met before, she'd actually come on the previous trip that I ran for him in Ireland. She has since, at the time she was a non-photographer, but since then she's taken up photography and is very serious about it. And she was really looking forward to photographing Ireland, to revisiting these places that she remembered and making photographs. And on the morning when I picked them up from the airport, along with the rest of the group, you know, she was feeling like she'd a bit of a cold coming on. And John had just recovered from a cold. So she's going, great, now, you know, I'm going to get this cold. And the so she went out with us the first evening. And then the next morning, she was completely flattened by a flu or something, really just completely laid her for six. Like she said later on, she's never been as sick in her life. So John, is, you know, if he'd been running that trip by himself, and I could feel for him because I'm like, my God, if I was in this position, what would I do? But... And this is a reason why I often run trips with other photographers.
You just abandon the weak. Leave them behind.
Leave them behind. But yeah, it was a case of, you know, he was... Now, he would have gone and run the trip, you know, but he was able to take care of her and make sure that she... And, you know, it wasn't man flu. Like, she needed to be taken care of.
I mean, that's a good way of looking at it. You could actually say, look, your presence gave him the opportunity to be with her.
Yeah.
Rather than looking at it saying, you know, thank God you were there, you saved the entire trip.
Exactly.
Because he would have soldiered through,
and she would have understood because, and that's the way it is.
But mind you, for marketing purposes, you saved the entire trip, Peter.
Naturally. But it was great, you know, because I mean, I'm used to running these things, and it was just one of those things where, you know, I was happy to do it. I'm happy to be able to do the thing so that he was released to be able to take care of his wife. And he did come out with us whenever he could. But, you know, for about half the time, at least for the first part of the trip, it was just me. But it brought home to me again that I run trips with other photographers because I enjoy running trips with other photographers. It's, you know, the workload is a bit reduced. You've got somebody you can sort of, you know, have a bit of banter with. And the clients always get an enjoyment, a level of enjoyment from it as well, because you get more than one opinion and more than one input on different styles and different approaches. But there's also the nice safety factor of if something goes wrong, somebody can manage.
The element of redundancy is kind of nice to have on a trip like that.
It is, yes.
Not that you'd ever want to feel redundant, but...
No, yes. Indeed, yes.
It is a comforting thing to have, I can imagine, absolutely. Just talking about what's on your schedule. You've already mentioned looking at 2020 already, but other things, what have you got coming up in the next sort of month or so, next couple of weeks that you're starting work on or that you're thinking about turning? Because all this talk of all these trips is great, but when are you going to do some photography, goddammit?
I know, right?
Welcome to me. I mean, this is not Peter Cox's travel podcast. You don't run a travel agency of crying out loud. Allegedly, you're a photographer.
Allegedly, it's been claimed from time to time. So yes, I the last time I did a book project was in 2014, 2015. At the time, I had sort of said, oh, you know, I'd like to every 2 to 3 years, I'd like to have a book out, and so it's now. Well, 2018, 2015, so it's 3 years since Atlantic Light came out, and I haven't yet. I had a couple of ideas for projects that haven't quite developed for various reasons, but I'm starting work this winter on a book on the islands, the West Coast Islands. It's one of those things that's interesting because I had these other ideas which I've shelved.
One of them, we won't say what it is.
Yes.
But one of them was held back by the fact that your imagination just far outstripped the technology available at the moment to do it.
Pretty much, yeah. And so that's, I'm hoping in a few years that will change. So I'm putting that one on the back burner. But I had these ideas. And I also, because Atlantic Light was all aerial photographs, I had this idea that my next project should be all one thing or the other, which was a stupid idea. But it just was lodged in my head that this was the rule I had to follow. And actually, I was talking to Norm McCluskey, who's a very good photographer based in Kenmare. And one of the things I had been thinking of was islands and doing a book on the islands. But it hadn't crystallized into this is what I'm going to do. And we were chatting away anyway and about projects and so on, because he's working on a project that he's nearly finished with at the moment. And he said, oh, Peter, you should do a book on the islands. And I was like, you know, because it was like boing back to the foreground and actually, you know, I should. So I have to give Norm his credit for that, because he did. He pushed it from sort of something hovering in the back of my mind into the forefront. So it'll be, you know, the exact structure of it's a bit loose at the moment, but it'll be essentially covering some number of the Western Islands, the more interesting ones, from a multiplicity of viewpoints, from surface, from land, and from the air. You know, so yeah, starting work on that probably in the next couple of weeks.
Have you got any end date in mind, or are you just going to work until you feel, okay, now I've got a body of work I can turn into a book?
So, yeah, I'd like it to be a year, but it'll probably be longer. I get the feeling it's going to be longer. I want to do a really nice, really in-depth look at these things and not just be superficial about it. So that means going out, spending time. It means revisiting. And so, you know, and also I'm not 100% clear on the structure of the book. I have ideas and I have a basic framework in mind. But I think what will happen is as I'm out and working, that will solidify and I'll become more aware of what the book is actually going to be.
Feel your way into it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to it because it's difficult for me to go out and just make photographs with no particular impetus, you know. And so I photograph on workshops, but outside of workshops, I don't do a whole lot of photography, but unless I'm working a project, and I haven't had one of those in a couple of years. So I'm just really looking forward to getting stuck into this.
Final topic, because we have covered quite a lot, but we can't let this particular topic slip. And you're trying to read off my notes, think which topic is he going to raise? Which of the many ones that we haven't touched upon is he going to touch upon here? But your photographs appear in book form. They also appear in print form. Talk about a fantastic little segue here. But you had quite a significant print order.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, I did an order for a hotel in Dublin, the Ripley Court Hotel in Dublin, and the owner of the hotel came into the gallery, and Carol managed to convince him that he should place. Actually, he didn't take much convincing at all, but
yeah, don't say that. Carol will be expecting a pay rise if you say that. Carol, if you're listening, he didn't mean it.
No, Carol did a fantastic, because I wasn't there. I was actually out on a job. And actually I was in the, it was the middle of a film shoot actually. And I got a call from Carol and she knew that I was, you know, busy that day. So to see that there was a call coming in, I knew that it was something important. And she said, well, there's this guy here and he's looking to purchase a certain number of prints. And because it was a windy location, I couldn't hear her very well. And then she gave me a figure that, you know, the order was worth, and it was a good figure, but the discount that was being discussed was excessive for the figure that I thought I'd heard. And then I realized that I'd missed a zero on the figure. And so I was like, okay, well, that's a different one. And so we discussed it. But yeah, when I delivered the order, you know, he was saying wonderful things about her, because she's fantastic. But yes, it was very nice to get. And it was basically photographs for the rooms of the hotel. And also for some of the public areas. But it's one of those things that, you know, I've done a couple of these and they're always fantastic to get, but then you've actually got to produce.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it's fantastic to get the order in and go, lovely, and to see that extra zero on what it's going to give you, but then you've got to do the job.
Yeah.
So, I mean, can you say how many prints it was, roughly?
It was 180 or something like that.
So 180
yeah.
prints.
Yeah.
Which you're running off your little A3 printer.
Yes, my 44-inch A3 printer.
Yes. Yeah. So how long does it take to print 180-odd prints?
It doesn't take the printing. The printing isn't that bad. It's because, you know, the printer does the, you know, it's coming off in a roll and it's quite a lot of prints and you do it over a period of time, but the main problem is framing. And the last time I did a hotel order, we were doing our own framing entirely, so we were making everything from scratch, and that was I had to get in a few extra people to help with that. And this time we recently, during the summer, we changed. We no longer make our frames from scratch. We buy them from a company that actually provides us with made frames, and then we essentially, you know, dry mount the image and put it into the, reassemble the frame sandwich, and then put it on the wall. So the frames look the same. They're done to our specification, but we don't have to cut the wood and pin the wood and cut the glass to size, all that kind of thing. And so it's made life an awful lot easier. Mm-hmm. And it made life very, well, it wasn't easy for this job because it's still 180 things you've got to put together. And you've got to, you know, you get the print, you've got to dry them out the print, you've got to make sure the glass is clean on both sides. And you've got to do that for all of these things. So Carol did quite a lot of the work early on by herself while I was off traveling. And then when I came back, we knuckled under and we worked together for, it probably took us, I mean, it probably took 3 weeks really of work to get the whole thing done, which was, so it was, but it was very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't, we didn't feel that we were under the gun particularly. I mean, we did, there was a couple of long days toward the end just to make sure we got everything out in time. And then, you know, it's interesting because, we looked at the pictures as they were all laid out in the upstairs gallery, you know, ready for a delivery. And Carol and I were both looking at them going, wow, that's a lot of photographs. That's really impressive. And then we both were taking our phones out to take pictures of them, you know, to show people how much work we'd done. And we looked at the pictures and we actually did this separately because I did it by myself and Carol had done it either earlier or did it later. And we were discussing it the next day. And I said, yeah, I took the picture and it just doesn't look like that much when in the photograph. She's like, I had exactly the same problem. She said, I was trying to find every angle where I could show how many pictures there are, but it just didn't look like all that much when you photograph it.
Which is bizarre because, I mean, I've got a big nose, but when I take a selfie, my nose just grows. So to think that something like that then just looks smaller and less impressive is, well, actually, that does happen as a landscape photographer. Surely you arrive at Vista and you're looking at it and you think, holy cow, this is just amazing. And then you looking at it at the back of the camera and suddenly it's a little bit less impressive. I mean, how do you get around that?
Well, it's. I mean, the interesting thing about that is that sometimes, yes, that can happen, but then it's all about finding the right foreground. And the funny thing is that sometimes these foregrounds, and in fact, just going back briefly to Svalbard, you know, you'd find foregrounds that would be the size of a laptop and you'd be so low and close to them. Like the foreground area of the photograph is the size of a laptop, right?
Yeah.
And you get low and close with a wide angle lens and it looks really dramatic and it looks like it's something much bigger. But in fact, if you were another photographer...
Talking about my nose again, aren't you?
If you were another photographer trying to find the spot where that photograph was taken from, you could step over it and never see it.
Yeah. You're arriving there thinking, oh, this is an amazing foreground. It's huge.
Yeah.
It's got this... and you're looking for something bigger. And actually, it's... There you go. Good tip.
There you are.
Exactly. Foreground.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we should knock it on the head. If somebody listening to this podcast wants to order 180 prints, where can they find out more about you? Where can they get in touch with you? How do people see your work, connect with you?
So there's obviously, if you're not local to Killarney, then you go to the website, which is petercox.ie. If you are looking to do a photography workshop or a photography tour, then it's elevation.ie. And naturally, if you're in the area of Kerry and Killarney, you can drop into the gallery, which is on Plunkett Street.
You're on social media at all?
Allegedly.
Very good.
So, yes.
Allegedly, and only if you're in Wi-Fi range.
Allegedly, yes, yes. I've become much worse with the social media, but I'm on Instagram as @PeterCoxPhotography and Facebook as PeterCoxPhoto.
Well, listener, thank you very much for taking the time to listen to us. And, well, we'll be back. Maybe.
Sometime.